You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
It is an absolute joy to welcome Padraig O'Tooma back to the Pagoda. Poet, theologian, podcaster, his wordsmithing hold both healing and challenge. You may recognise his voice from Radio 4 or Poetry Unbounded or his interviews on the On Being podcast. He's published widely in the fields of poetry, anthology, essay, memoir, theology and conflict. And after tonight's reading, there'll be a book signing over in G Books when he will be both signing, Feed the Beast that he's talking from tonight, reading from tonight. And there are copies of Poetry Unbound as well in the bookstore, so you can pick those up. But tonight he's going to be mainly sharing from Feed the Beast. And I want to share with you this beautiful review from Joelle Taylor. Tender, heartbreaking and lyric. An exploration into exile and exorcism as it applies to gay men. This is a book of griefs and resurrection. Beautiful. So we look forward to a beautiful evening. Greenbelt Pagoda, give it up for Padraig O'Tooma.
Well, hello. How nice to see you all. It is a joy to be at Greenbelt. I missed last year, but I think I've been here every year since 2003, and so it is an absolute joy to be with you, and thank you very much for coming along tonight. Thank you for the wonderful people who put so much love into making Greenbelt happen, and the wonderful people who put so much love into being Greenbelt by coming. So thanks very much. I'm going to be talking about your devils tonight. I hope you have plenty, and I hope they're hungry. So just to let you know, I think you might have known this if you saw the little write-up. I am going to make reference to exorcisms tonight, as well as so-called reparative therapies for curing the gay, which clearly does no such thing as the kind. But mind yourself, look after yourself. If you need to leave to go, actually, I can't cope with that tonight. That's a very wise decision. There's great people at Greenbelt, people with well-being on the back of their back, as well as the out at Greenbelt stall. I don't take the fact that I've come through this lightly. It took me a long time, and I don't take the same thing for you either. So I want you to make sure to look after yourself. That said, I do hope that we can have a small bit of pantomime during it. And so, you know, when somebody says something outrageous from the front of the stage and people say something like, "Oh, no, it's not," from the audience, will we be able to do that? Oh, no, we can't? Now, I'm going to do the thing that I hate, which is to say that was pretty lackluster. Make it pretend you're five and at the Christmas pantomime. Oh, yes, it is? Much, much better. Yeah. Gay devils can be cured. You tell you're in England when people go, "Can't." So, let's start off with the poem. I am very lucky in the sense that the Irish education curriculum, I'm 48, and the Irish education curriculum when I was growing up in school, just in the ordinary village school, was filled with poetry. From the age of 5 to 17, we were learning 2 poems off by heart every week. And so by the end of every year in school, you kind of had to know about 70 poems off by heart, half of them in English and half of them in Irish. And that was a magnificent thing for the brain and a magnificent thing for the introduction to that art. I'm so glad for it. And of course, I don't recall many of those poems at all. But when I read them, there's a part of my body goes, "You had this in your heart once. You knew it once." Even if it was only because I was petrified of the teacher and getting in trouble. It wasn't like we were having great literary criticism. But I have imbibed poetry my entire life, and I loved it, and I continue to love it. And here's a little poem in praise of poetry, really. I want to start off with a poem of gratitude, because I am convinced that part of why I turned to religion was because there was an intuitive indigenous part of me really, really wanted to turn to poetry. And it's poetry that saved me. and I'm grateful to poetry. So here's a little science fiction poem about parallel universes. It's short, it's called The One Thing. There must have been some other me who lived some other time, who realized he knew the one thing that would save me. And he must have found a little window, opened it, and shouted through it that saving sound that saved me. And he must have felt a failure, I am sure, that other me, because he failed. He did. He didn't save me from all those things that beat me. And he must have sat like some sad god from sadder scriptures and wept at all he failed to do. He had so little time. But all my life, I've been climbing up to little windows, opening them, and saying the one thing I can say back. Thank you. Thank you. Part of my problem was that I really, really wanted to believe in religion. And I really, really wanted to take this stuff seriously. So when I heard at the age of 11 that gay people were abominations, and then I heard through charismatic ecumenism that, you know, you could be cured or that you had devils in you, and that there was all kinds of ways within which gay people were manifestations of evil in the world, I took that very seriously. I used to try to keep notes. I used to try to understand what words like righteousness meant. It's absolutely ridiculous to try to understand what words like righteousness meant when you're 16. So here's a poem called Notes on Righteousness. They're little pieces on scrap paper, really, this poem. Little bits and pieces. Notes on Righteousness. Everybody told me I was wrong, but something in me said I wasn't. If I am mistaken, even if God lays down his pen and shuts his book, I'll still have my say. If I am correct, then erect me like an evergreen. You can suffer in sulfur. You can wander far from mapped land and still find a way to say the things that others say are unsayable. Feed me. Do you know men who still wrap themselves around themselves at night? Many of us still sleep like this. Kiss, kiss. When the devil, dressed in velvet, slid near me, he whispered to me with his silky tongue. I hung my head and stared down at my body, hummed a tune of shame. The devil slipped away. One God went to grow a congregation. One God and God's rabid dog went to grow a congregation. Three gods went to grow a congregation. Three gods, two gods, one God and God's rabid dog went to grow a congregation. Did you know that mega comes from mu, comes from meh, meaning sacrifice? How many sacrifices were made in the pursuit of greatness? If you want me, you can find me down where your light dims. Here I can breathe and smell old trees. Here there's turf and fire. So, when I was 18, I was part of an ecumenical, charismatic group of Christians. And it is important to say, because they told me I had a devil, but I don't want to imply that they did. The things they said about gay people have plagued me, and the things they did to me in the name of hearing that I was gay have plagued me. But from them, I learned of bravery, of folks from different political points of view in both jurisdictions of Ireland, British-identified people, Irish-identified people, having serious conversations about politics and learning how to listen. So while they were, homophobic doesn't even describe it, I was launched on a career of conflict mediation through surviving that. And it is important to say that. I learned a lot from people. And I don't think that just because in some ways they were devoid of imagination and integrity when it came to gay people, that they weren't, that they were without imagination and integrity everywhere. Of course they weren't. Some of these were brave people who'd suffered through terrible traumas. And they weren't homophobic because of that. But they, we can have integrity in one part of our lives and not in the other. And so before I talk about some of these things, I want to say I don't think these people were devils. I don't know what they were. They'd have to speak for themselves. But I don't call them devils. Perhaps I call them limited in imagination. So when I was 18, I joined this group and I had indicated on the application form that I suffered from homosexuality. That was the phrase. And so within the first week of being a member of this prayer group, they'd arranged the first of three public exorcisms. And about 15 or 16 years later, I thought, I need to start writing about these things, because by that stage, I'd forgotten about these exorcisms and almost found them funny. And I needed that time to be able to look back through the lens of art. And so I wrote seven sonnets. I call them seven deadly sonnets. It's a bit of a play on seven deadly sins. And some of these are shocking. Some of these are painful. These have strong language. But partly for me, they're emblems of defiance and joy, because it's a great thing to have survived and to look back and to say, look at what language can do. And look at, you know, the amounts of edits. Like, I worked on these sonnets for years before I published them. And it's a great joy to look at these as items of art and not as items of trauma. These are where I get to have the last word. And that last word is not, you're all bastards, because that doesn't interest me anymore. It would have at one point. The last word really is to say, isn't art interesting? And look at what art does to us. So here's the first. It's called The Exorcist. My first exorcist was a woman from the country of California. And so I'm sure there might be an American or two here. I don't blame all of you. Just the Californians. The Exorcist. I wished you weren't American. I wished you didn't see intrinsic evil in me. I wished you hadn't dragged my secret from me. Now I know you knew already. Someone squealed. I wished you didn't put your hands on me while you were screaming at the devils in me, all my homosexualities. I wished you'd never gathered people round, instructing them to pray in tongues or read from Revelations or chant, Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. I wished you'd shut up. I repeated, Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. I wished he'd answered. I wished you dead. And I was frightened at the violence in me and the nest of demons in me. I wondered where they lived. In my semen? In the dreams I had of being kissed? Why did they breed in me? My God, my exorcist. I think part of what saved me in the writing of all of these was that I knew I was going to only write sonnets. And a sonnet can be anywhere from 11 to 17 lines long. But I committed to writing 14-line sonnets. It was the form that shaped me. And I really, really wanted to write sonnets that were in what you'd call the Irish mode, which is where there isn't formal rhyme, but there's repeated syncopated rhyming patterns and elongated vowels and other forms of percussion the whole way throughout it. And for me, having the form and the art form to focus on was what made the story, the drama, the violation of those original exorcisms kind of slip into the background. Because I thought, this is a theater stage to make now. And it was so enlivening to look with joy to go, I wonder what I can do. And at one point I thought, I wonder if I can get the same word six times into two lines, just to see how audacious can I be with repetition. And it was the word Jesus. You know, she says, Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. And she did get people to say that. And then I crouch down and I repeat, Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. And for me, it's an awful memory. But for me, I go, I managed to get the same word 6 times into 2 lines of poetry. How cool is that? And it's a way to say, isn't it fantastic to know stuff about form and to see what form can do and to see how art often can move the gaze somewhere else. Here's the third exorcism. This makes reference to sexual violence. The exorcism. I should say the third exorcism, the first one was done in this public place. The second one was done with only men. Apparently testicles help exorcisms go a little bit deeper, but that didn't work with me. And the third one, I was told to go into a room and lock myself in there and stay until the devil was gone. And that was actually the worst one, because in a way I was being recruited to be my own oppressor, which I already had been, but this formalized it. So here's a sonnet about that. The Exorcism, Part 3. The way to break a man is to make him hate himself. So I found myself at doorways, one at the top of steps where my exorcisers waited, getting absolution from a priest who thrust his crotch into my face. Shaking outside a bar, I was too chaste to enter, and now this empty room. Divide and conquer works for countries, people too. The exorciser said my sexuality would change if I called down my authority in Jesus, a prize for true believers. So they emptied out a room where I could cast out all my devils by myself, till what's inside of you is outside of you. I locked the door, prayed harder than I'd prayed before, stayed an hour. When I came out saying I was still unfree, they said I was beyond their powers, but they'd heard about a man who knew psychology, a trusted Christian man who'd cure me. He'd make me truly, finally, manly. Yeah, that's the stage where you could have said, oh no, he wouldn't. Did anybody learn Shakespeare's famous sonnet 130 in school? My mistress's eyes are nothing like the sun. It's a famous sonnet. He goes on for 12 lines about how ordinary looking his mistress is. And you think, I don't think she's going to be too happy to get this little rhyming sonnet. And then line 13 and 14, he does this thing called a volta, a turn, a twist. And all sonnets have a volta. And he says, but I swear. And then he speaks just for 2 lines about how magnificent she is. And so I made a composite character of all my reparative therapists and exorcists, because there was a small community of them. And I wrote a poem after Shakespeare's sonnet 130 that speaks back to that. This is called Volta, because that's the word in Italian for when a sonnet turns on itself. Volta. My exorciser's eyes were nothing like the sun. They had no fire. If twisted be the language bad priests speak, his tongue was like a lyre, sweeter than the Eucharist. If hate be harsh, why then his actions felt more tender than a father's. I have heard the furious from the pulpit. This man's work was quiet as abuse. I loved the promises he made. They wound around my heart with knots of wonder. I have heard of charlatans who charge. I swear he would have paid me for my custom. His rates were reasonable and his burden subtle. Some terrorize. He Christianized. I swear to you, his heaven rhymed with hell. I know he'll claw his way to glory. Me as well. For me, the volta in that poem comes just in the last 3 words. I'm sure for this man, he did, and perhaps still does, I don't know him at all, care about getting into heaven. That isn't a concern of mine. But part of me thought, well, if there is one and he's going to claw his way in, The only revenge I hope for is that he's shocked to see me there. And it would have been easy to have written, and in fact I did write a few sonnets of revenge, and entertaining though they were actually intellectually unstimulating, because it's easy to curse somebody. You know, you see lots of people do that. I didn't want to curse him. I kind of wanted to hope for him to improve, and the collections of these men to improve their lives as well. I did a poetry reading in a very queer bookshop in Melbourne in Australia, years after all these exorcisms, and there was all kinds of instruction manuals for the homos inside this very queer bookshop, and it was a place of great community learning and community support as well. There was signs on the walls for refugee communities who were living with HIV. They have a meeting on Tuesday mornings, and people who are, you know, living with this particular circumstance, there's a meeting group here, and there's a reading group. Like, it was a great community hub. Hares and Hyenas, it was called in Melbourne. It's gone now, sadly. So I was asked to do a poetry reading there, and I was delighted. And I got up to do the poetry reading, and I looked up, and right in front of me was one of my former reparative therapists. I know. And guess whose hand he was holding? Another man. Oh, no, he wasn't. Oh, bloody hell, he was. And I kind of credit the need for me beginning to write these poems then, because I saw him, and I mean, like, the dogs on the street knew that man was gay. And I saw him, and I thought, well, I am glad that he is not doing those terrible things, and I'm glad he's found somebody. But there was something in me just thought, under no circumstances do I want to catch his eye properly or make any conversation with him afterward. And there was something about the energy of revulsion in me about that I thought, I've got some work to do. Not because I feel like I need to find him out and make some reconciliation, but just because there was something in me that I thought, I've got some rage in me. And lots of the poems in this book, Feed the Beast, are in a certain sense putting some kind of shape to rage and trying to meet rage with art and trying to see how can rage be elevated or descended through some kind of art. Anyway, when I did see him, I thought of Dante's Inferno. There's a good reason why you should learn poetry, because if you are ever giving a poetry reading in a very queer bookshop and you see your reparative therapist sitting in front of you holding the hand of his husband or partner, you can quote what Dante says in the Inferno when he finally gets down to the ninth circle of hell and finally sees the devil, because there's nine circles of hell where terrible things happen, but there's no devil. And you keep on going, what's going to happen? Where's the devil? And Dante finally gets down with his companion Virgil, and they see the devil there in a lake, frozen in a lake of his own tears. And Dante sees this impotent devil and says, oh, what a marvel it appeared to me. And I love Dante's Inferno. And when I saw this guy in front of me holding the hand of his lover, I thought, oh, what a marvel it appeared to me. So here's the last of the seven deadly sonnets. Guess what it's called? Oh, what a marvel it appeared to me. I knew it was him as soon as I saw him. He saw me too. I was curious if he'd changed. I like to believe people do, eventually. 10 years since he'd made me account for what he called homosexual erections in weekly sessions he called therapy. I've got plenty of obsessions. It's just that he's not one of them anymore. All it took was time and safety. 5 years. 20. I don't know how I made it through. When I saw him, I gave him what he said God gave me. Silence. Opportunity. Of course, lots of people of all sexualities and genders have spent a long time thinking, what is behind homophobia, transphobia? And I mean, I'm I grew up Catholic, and like the Catholic Church is half run by gay men, and we still don't ordain women. And part of me thinks that behind so much homophobia is an absolute primal misogyny. Because since I've been much more out about being gay, there's various conservative churches that are nonetheless a bit funky. Maybe the pastor has stubble or has an iPod or something, or tattoos. But they still don't think women should preach. But I regularly enough get messages from people to say, you know, our church is on a journey, and we'd like to invite you to speak on Sunday night at our informal church service. It's not a communion. It's an informal church service. And part of me thinks how fascinating that these churches would sooner have a gay guy that they are convinced is going to hell speak than they would a woman. So here is a little sonnet called Who for Us Men and for Our Salvation. There isn't one person in mind with this. Don't try guessing. And it's dedicated to two extraordinary theologians that I know, Sarah Williamson and Philippa Jordan. Who for Us Men and for Our Salvation. You drink whiskey during poker nights, wear shirts your granddad wore, display the ink that's on your unshaved chest, and sign your texts to me with X's. You drink coffee from a little glass after early morning yoga class. You podcast authenticity and live in parts of the city that others have disdained. You disdain disdain. You oil your beard. You wear 1930s shoes bought for a small fortune in a place you say your granddad would have loved. Like him, you believe a woman's place is not behind the pulpit. Let her lecture in literature. Let her explore the stars. Let her drink. Let her work. But do not let her speak the verb of God in public. Let her mostly be. You know the way at the end of gospel readings in some churches you say, this is the word of the Lord at the end of it, and people say, thanks be to God. In Irish, you don't say, this is the word of the Lord. You say, this is the verb of God, shabri her day. And that, when people hear that, they go, oh my God, that's beautiful. You know, the verb is the action, etc. But I think mostly, because when the Mass was translated into Irish, it was only in the 60s. I think mostly it was because the fact that if you want to say, this is the word of the Lord, the word for Irish for word is fuckle. And so you'd have to say, shaw fuckle day. And I think the people in the 60s were like, let's find another way to say something here, because otherwise everybody will be coming to Mass just for that one half a second when you get to say it together in public. And while I do love the richness of the idea of the verb of God, I kind of wish that we spoke about the fuckle of God instead. So, F-O-C-A-I-L, you can look it up. I'm not making it up. Yeah, I mean, I'm very happy to use strong language, but in this instance, I'm actually not. Where are we going? One of the complicated things about having survived all this, and in some ways, you know, I had 3 exorcisms and 2 years of reparative therapy, so-called. In some ways, in many ways, I suppose I consider my experience relatively mild. And even in a mild situation, one of the things that it does is it pathologizes sex. And so I have a little sexual poem, but unfortunately it isn't very juicy, because it's about disappointment and embarrassment and shame. It's called Not Drowning, Burning. Dance like everybody's watching, he said. Otherwise, what's the point? Then he rattled off some proverb in Russian and told me to guess the meaning. He whispered it in my ear again. Feeling flirty, I guessed something about undressing, but he laughed and said, no, those destined to burn will never drown. Later, when he made moves to get me horizontal, I was all lit up with shame. He stopped, said, let's warm up. And then he kissed me. Not all men are so kind when lying down. We wound our way to an all-night tea shop, and he whistled harmonies to Tchaikovsky while I looked around for anything to keep me going. Him fluent, me flaring. Him fluid, me fire. One of the things of equality, I think, that we can register is that those of us who have been religion affected in our life, there has often been, of whatever sexual identity or gender identity or orientation we have, there has often been profound shame when it comes to the language of sex, and that so much idolatry and obsession about purity and speaking about masturbation like it's going to send you directly into the inferno, that has led to a deep influency in the language of pleasure and in the language of shared pleasure and the language of communication about sex. I've met so many people, straight people, queer people, everybody in between, even a few Australians who have said yes, that there was an enormous level of having to discover a new vocabulary when you found yourself in a safe enough sexual relationship. Some of those sexual relationships were temporary, but so safe that actually they introduced something a little bit like a blessing into somebody's life, that could be a companion in many ways to the awful years of shame that have been so ingrained in so many religion-affected people of all the orientations and the genders when it comes to thinking about the shared language of pleasure and beauty between our bodies when we have consensual relationships. In a while, I'm going to take a few questions. But let me read a little poem, kind of about forgiveness first, because I know you're desperate for that. Oh, no, we're not. This is very short. I was in a chapel once years ago, and I looked up and I saw one of my exercisers completely coincidentally sitting a little bit away from me. And of course, I wanted to get the hell out of the chapel. And I had this extraordinary experience. I don't know what you'd call it. Just for half a second, I found myself in some kind of cavern, some quiet cave of the softest, grayest, gentlest light, almost like dawn was just happening outside. And from somewhere through the rocks, maybe, dawn was making its way in. There was a quiet pool in the corner of this cave. And it happened. I wasn't looking for it. I wasn't hoping for it. It happened for a split second, like one of those flashbacks you see in a film. And then it was gone. But it was so arresting. It occurred to me that it's one of the things that art can do. It can just, in a tiny moment, give you something where you go, my imagination is inspired here. And I actually stopped caring about this fella in the corner and was much more interested in, what was that place? Where is it? I feel it in me. And again, many years later, I wrote a poem about it. So I'll read this short poem. It rejoices in the unhappy title of Abomination, but it is a glad poem. And then we'll take some questions. Abomination. Forgiveness? You can have it if you want it. Most days I practice forgetting the hold you once had on me. Mostly it works. Most days. There is a cave I got to once while shaking in a corner of your chapel. When I found myself there, I forgot I was in your lair. The cave came to me and with me. I make my way there from time to time. It comes with no demand. I enter through the gate that has a sign that once said, danger. So there's a traveling mic. Share your name and then launch into a very, very long question that at the end of which you say, I suppose it's a comment, really. We all love that.
Thanks, Padre. Just to remind you as well that this evening's being recorded, so please make sure that whatever you share that you own and you're happy for that to go on the recording. And as Padre said earlier, the wellbeing team are at the back, so if you need them or you need to leave at any point, then please trust yourselves. I'll start across this side. Just wave.
Hello, my name is Emma. Porrick, where do you see the ongoing peace and reconciliation process on the island of Ireland benefiting from a reconnection to language and landscape and poetry, as you were talking about at the beginning?
So just in case folks couldn't hear, the question from Emma was, where do I see the ongoing process of peace and reconciliation of the island of Ireland connecting to land and language and landscape and the arts? I'm very grateful for what peace treaties can do. As a straw poll, how many people here have read the Good Friday Agreement? Yeah, very few. The last number of years, particularly thinking of Brexit, has been a demonstration about quite how inept political language has been when it comes to speaking about Britain's relationship with its neighbours. When you read the Good Friday Agreement, you go, bloody hell, look at what we're capable of. It is the most beautiful document of, at times, artistic demonstration about how it is that countries that have done terrible things between themselves can speak to each other. And like, I think the Good Friday Agreement is filled with something like art. The opening of it commends itself by saying, in a spirit of concord, which means shared heart, we commend this agreement to you. And it also says, like, the history of the island of Ireland and the history of Britain's involvement in the island of Ireland over the last 600 years has shown that there is no possibility of any single sitting of government solving what has gone on between us. And what we need is the recognition that A, sovereignty of the island of Ireland belongs to the people of Ireland, and B, we need a transformation of communities. And that, to my mind, is the demonstration of something like poetry infusing something like politics. And like, I find myself wondering, who was it that named those clauses? Who was it that said, let's use the word concord? And what I love is that that wasn't saying, well, let's all open up to a page of Seamus Heaney's poetry, beautiful as that is. It was saying, let's make what we're tasked to do something of the quality of poetry and something of the quality of beautiful language. And when you hear beautiful language like that, you go, that's the level of expectation we should have for our for the documents that are speaking to us about how it is we relate to each other across borders. And I kept on looking for something like that coming out, particularly from England, because I thought that Brexit seemed particularly to be an English anxiety of very important concerns. But I wanted people, leaders in England, to give you language that you were worthy of. And I kept on thinking, you're not being given such language. You're being failed by people not giving you elevated, and I don't mean highfalutin, I mean language of beauty that speaks to something powerful. And that's for people who wanted Brexit or not. I'm not saying that it would have led things in one way or another, but I think the language was failing. And what I look for from anybody who's tasked with public office is that they think about their words. Because if you don't, well, you're going to be judged for your words. We often want to be judged for our intention or what we really meant or what we'd say now that we've had a bit of time to think. But if you're in a situation where words are what you're being tasked for, you need to be held accountable for those words. And so I always want to hope that people will use beautiful language and be infused by the power of beautiful language if they're being asked to use language in public, which isn't to say you need to sound like you've just been, you know, reading Ovid that morning. But it does mean that you've got to say, I need to use words that I love. And I need to use words that are not trying to be violent and are not trying to deceive, that there has to be a quality of integrity. And so I say all that because I think all language, whether it's in poetry, whether it's in literature, whether it's in the way that we speak about the landscape, that all language can have the possibility of beauty in it. And if it doesn't, we're screwed. And I hope that people who are tasked with the burden of language in public can turn to beautiful language. And I hope poetry helps, but there's all kinds of ways people can get there. So, yeah. I should also say that there's been some pretty violent poets. I mean, you only have to read some of what Edmund Spenser wrote to go, all right, yes, just because you write beautiful lines, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's beautiful content. So, other questions?
Thank you. Hi, my name's Ruth. Just going back to your poetry, I was just wondering, how do you feel after your latest collection? So how do you feel having those, maybe those words, those feelings, those experiences now sort of come out and written and out there? And does that unblock something for you? So what does that free you up to think about next or to reflect on now?
Oh, that's a lovely question. Thank you. I missed your name at the start.
Ruth.
Ruth. Thanks, Ruth. What does it do? I'm not sure, because partly writing them was a sign of freedom. I wouldn't have put them out there if I was uncomfortable, because these are so personal and they are very particularly personal ones. If I felt in any way awkward, I'd have thought, well, these are clearly poems that need to be private for a while. So in a way, it was kind of evidence of being far, far away from the shock of them in the initial phase. I get contacted all the time by people who've read them that say that's happened to me and that they've been through that too. So I feel in a strange way that like they're a small bridge, or it opens up a little window between people who have been put through for reasons of sexual identity or gender identity or orientation or all kinds of sexual shaming tactics that groups can use. So I see them as some kind of communication pattern across groups of people. So I'm just very grateful, and it's evidence of freedom for me, and there wasn't a second of embarrassment about them being out there, or a second of regret, or a second of shame, which is an absolutely lovely place to get to. There's a question there.
Hello, my name's James. There were a couple of things that struck me when you were talking at the start about being afraid of your teacher, and you kind of alluded to a fear of failure. Yeah. And I think often it's the kind of fear of the rules and the doctrines that we're in that kind of stops us from coming out of the closet.
Yeah.
I wondered if you could speak a bit about your journey, I guess, earlier on, in terms of creativity and play, and how that helped you in your coming out journey and coming to a place of self-acceptance.
Well, that's, thanks, James, you said. I was so lucky that there was so much poetry in the school curriculum, and that I'm just one of the lucky ones who happen to like poetry. And so I was writing poetry from the age of 11. I began writing poems about being gay from maybe the age of 15. I used to invent kind of hieroglyphics, a certain kind of code, and write them in that. And then I'd instantly forget what that code was. And so I couldn't read my own damn poems. So like for years I had these, I mean, they were just written in all these squiggles and shapes. And it was kind of like writing in tongues, queer tongues on the paper. I'm grateful for those, though, because they showed that if nowhere else on the page, there was the possibility of saying something. It was often difficult. I remember that at times when I was writing some of those coded poems or poems in English that I was actually able to read back, or Irish, and I was making some veiled reference to being gay, I'd close my eyes while I was writing it out as a teenager because I couldn't bear to see what was on the page. But nonetheless, there was this absolute impulse to make. That's what a poem means. A poem comes from the Greek word poemia, meaning a made thing. And when you're making a piece of art, it's making you back. And strangely, it becomes bigger than the maker. And you're not ultimately in control of it. Somehow, there's something else that happens when you make something. And I don't mean it's going to become your profession or you're going to become well known for it. Primarily, art is a private act that we do as some kind of self-salvation and some kind of mystery, because we've always done it. Somebody put their hand on a wall and filled their mouth with some kind of clay and spat around it. Why? Were they saying, I am here, or this is mine, or is there anybody else like me? I have no idea. But they were compelled to do it. It's like this existential question. Who am I? Who are we? This is mine. Don't come near. Stay away. Come close. Possibly it's saying all of those things, you know. It's filled with ambivalence. And I think it's that impulse to make and to go, I don't know what it means, that's behind so much art. And what has been so beneficial for me as somebody who has been propelled to poetry my whole life has been that poetry was the one place where I could say what I wanted and where I could deliberately leave ambivalences there and use line breaks. And the more I learned technique, I could see how a poem could hold plural possibilities. And unfortunately, the language of religion that I was being taught so often was one of a certain addictive nature to certitude, to go have it right, have it absolutely right, have this more pure than a quadratic equation that resolves itself perfectly when it comes to your thought. And that's a diminishment, really, of the human enterprise. We're filled with ambivalence and strangeness. And my life has been saved by knowing that you can turn to the page and knowing that the page can say multiple things. Reading poems about midlife, reading poems about rage, poems about Irish Revolution, my whole life. It's just given a space for hope and dashed hope and yearning and dreams and nightmares and satisfaction and dissatisfaction. It's a fine vehicle that can hold that. And that absolutely meant that I could trust what a page of a poem can do, not because it gives answers, but because it refuses to. And that has been a very, very fine artistic confrontation to the addictive natures of certitudes that I was brought up within. And ultimately, it was allowing myself to look at religious texts through the lens of art rather than through the lens of authority that saved me and helped me move away.
Meryl's got a question she'd like me to read out, if that's okay. So if someone wanted to use poetry to heal or move on from institutional trauma, do you have any advice on how to start?
Yeah. My guess is that by asking the question, you've already started. I think there can be a great thing in copying. So find a poet who you like. And you think, their poem about this makes me think that it could be a little bit about some of my life. And just write an extra verse. I mean, don't publish it and pretend it's yours. But just find a way to allow whatever it is that's drawn you in through that poem to let you write something in response and then see what happens and then keep on doing it. And probably eventually you'll go, I wrote something myself. And it's kind of turned into its own thing. Nobody's written a new poem in a few thousand years. All of our poems are in conversation with other poems, whether formally or these great questions of the human condition that we've got. So many people write poems about what's my name or who am I or what does this mean or what does it mean to consider a flower or what it means to consider age when you've turned 50 or 70 or when you become a grandparent or when somebody dies. These are poems that are continually needing to be written and rewritten. So turn to whatever it is that you love and begin to add to it and then keep on doing that and see what happens. And I like the idea that a poem can heal, but also be open to the fact that maybe the poem's work is going to make you a bit angry and maybe that's its power. I don't know what a poem's going to do. And I know that the more I try to control it, the less of its own thing it is. And to just allow... Yeah, I don't write poems to keep other people happy anymore. I write poems to see what language can do on the page. And so having that engagement might be a lovely thing. Thanks. Is there one more?
Hi, thank you so much. Kind of off the back of that, actually, are there any poets or writers that have inspired you or that ask you to kind of return to yourself in any way?
Oh, so many. Can we go on for an extra hour while I give you a list? in many ways, that's the joy of Poetry Unbound, has been to have the opportunity to read about 400 books of poetry a year and to only make 40 programs. I wish that I could make 400 a year. I loathed the Irish poet Patrick Kavanagh when I was growing up. We had to learn so much of him, and now I love him. I remember he hated the county he was from, County Monaghan. I remember saying to our English teacher one day in school, like, if he hated this place so much, why did he write about it all the time? And I mean, her answer to me was, shut up and learn the poem. She was a lot of fun. But now I think, and I genuinely mean it, she was a lot of fun. But now part of me thinks, I wish she'd said, you've actually stumbled onto a serious question in art. Like, love and hate are almost always there on the page. And the fact that you've seen it makes me wonder, what do you hate? And how can you write about it? Like, 'cause, and that, in a strange way, I had unbeknownst to myself, stumbled into something about him that now is why I love him, because he's so filled with ambivalence. He loves and loathes the land that he's from. Partly because I have known his work my whole life. I love Lorna Goodison, if you know Lorna Goodison's work, Jamaican poet. She was poet laureate of Jamaica for 3 years. I think she was the first poet laureate of Jamaica. I could be wrong about that. I love the way that she uses a register of language that at times sounds like it's a hymn, but then it just turns and turns and turns. This beautiful, beautiful work. Her most recent book is called Mother Muse, and half of the poems in the book are about this nun in Kingston in Jamaica who worked in a home for troubled boys. And if there was ever a boy that came in who had fighting potential, she would teach the boy how to box, because more than religion, she loved boxing. And possibly more than boxing, she loved jazz. And so she mentored so many people who became well-known boxers and jazz musicians in Kingston. And I love what Lorna Goodison does in her work. She trained as a painter first, Lorna Goodison did. And so you see this painterly quality in what it is that she creates. And all of her book covers are of paintings that she's done. So Lorna Goodison. So that's just Patrick Kavanagh and Lorna Goodison, just two. But there are many, many more. I think I'm going to read a few more poems and then finish. Is that the plan? Yeah. Every now and then I wondered, am I capable of writing a happy poem? Oh, no, he's not. You haven't done very well at the old pantomime thing. I just want to point that out to you. Oh, yes, he has. I'm going to prove you wrong. I absolutely can't. Here's a poem about death. So, it's a haiku. There are so many old poems in Irish about praying to your death. And I love those. Well, they're prayers, I suppose, from the 1700s. And I love those. And part of me, working years in conflict resolution, part of me thought that there's a relationship between having a good relationship with the possibility of your own lack of power and how you are when it comes to conflict. And ultimately, I think within the context of that, that's about having a relationship with your death. So I wrote a poem that really is about that, but I wanted to think about the body. This poem is called How to Be Alone. It's in, for anybody who's interested, it's in little couplets. How to be alone. It all begins with knowing nothing lasts forever, so you might as well start packing now. In the meantime, practice being alive. There will be a party where you'll feel like nobody's paying you attention, and there will be a party where attention is all you'll get. What you need to do is to remember to talk to yourself between these parties. And again, there will be a day, a decade, when you won't fit in with your body, even though you're in the only body you're in. You need to control your habit of forgetting to breathe. Remember when you were younger, and you practiced kissing on your arm? You were onto something then. Sometimes harm knows its own healing. Comfort knows its own intelligence. Kindness, too. It needs no reason. There is a you telling you another story of you. Listen to her. Where do you feel anxiety in your body? The chest? The fist, the dream before waking, the head that feels like it's at the top of the swing, or the clutch of gut like falling and falling and falling and falling. It knows something. You are dying. Try to stay alive. For now, touch yourself. I'm serious. Touch yourself. Take your hand and place your hand someplace upon your body and listen to the community of madness that you are. You are such an interesting conversation. You belong here. I'll finish with two shorter poems. The less certitude or even interest I have in certitudes about religion, the more I find the texts of religion interesting. They're extraordinary art. They're extraordinary literature. Nobody was paid to write these peculiar books. And so it's really worthwhile looking at this literature that's lasted so many millennia. I mean, I put it on the same level as the Metamorphoses, as Gilgamesh, these texts that it's easy to think that they're primitive and ancient, but they are so contemporary. They're asking questions about what does meaning mean? What does a country mean? How do we relate to our neighbors? How do I relate to somebody who's different? And they are strange and wild. And I don't think it's possible to find moral characters almost anywhere in it. And so abandoning the idea that it's a moral instruction book suddenly makes you go, this is crazy. What happens next? It starts from the beginning. Here's a poem called The Butcher of Eden. I was always intrigued by chapter 3 of the book of Genesis, where the Adam and the Eve have eaten of the fruit, and then the God comes down and asks them who told them that they were naked. And then it says this strange text, now God made Adam and Eve coats of skins and dressed them. And I began to think of carcasses of animals, the Butcher of Eden. And when he was finished, he scraped fat from the backs of stretched skins, wiped the blood, sewed the seams, bit the thread with teeth, and said, dress yourselves in these. And they said, what is this verb? God shoved his knife into the earth and said, it's like make-believe, but for your body. They looked at all the meat still steaming from when it was alive. God said, eat, and watched while beasts of Eden fed on beasts of Eden. I'll finish with this. This is a poem in honor of Emily Dickinson. I take a poet every year and read through all of their work. And one year I thought, I'm going to tackle Emily Dickinson, go on a little safari and see if I come out alive. And it took me 2 years to read her poems, 1,775 of them, and her letters. And at the end of it, somebody said to me, you must know an awful lot about Emily Dickinson now. And I just thought, I know nothing about Emily Dickinson. I'm just glad to be alive. And so I was thinking about that and thinking about how the idea of reading in order to feel like, yeah, I've sorted that out now. I've climbed that mountain. I've put a flag on the top. And I don't think that that's what they meant. But the idea of reading for mastery, I'm not sure that that's the only motivation. So I'll finish with this as an homage to literature and with deep love to Greenbelt for years of being a place of art and language and meeting. It's just been such a joy to be here and to meet so many people who I see every year and I'm always thrilled to see. So thank you very much for coming along. And this is in thanks to you and in thanks to Greenbelt for being such a wonderful place. This is called Let the Waters Swarm with a Swarm of Living Beings. I've been swimming around here for a while now. And while I've never touched the ocean floor, I've tried. You notice things out here, the way the wind makes waves chop at odd angles, the way the water feels warmer at the top, the way the moon makes music when you're half dead with cold, the ways of frozen bones, the way the morning never feels the same. Once a seal came up to me and bumped me, came right up like a sea puppy, and I swear it smiled. I was floating happy after that. I said, this ocean is my home. Then the storm came, then the waves, then the lightning spiked the surface, thunder clapped, hungry beasts swam round me. I saw seagulls eyeing me for scraps. Thank you very much. See you at the book signing. Thank you so much for coming along.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.